Geopolitics and Empire is joined by Emmanuel Daniel, who's a global thought leader in the future of finance. He's got a long bio. He's an entrepreneur, writer, listed as a top 10 global influencer in the FinTech Power 50. His latest book, you can see right behind him, is The Great Transition, The Personalization of Finance is Here. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Mr. Daniel.
Hello, Ian. Very happy to be on your show. I've listened to some of your podcasts. There's a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, there's a lot of ground to cover in a short time. And I thought, you know, we spoke recently on my TNT show, more economy, CBDCs, digital currency, and that sort of thing. And I don't know if you did this just for me. You know, I had wanted to talk about geopolitics in China, and you're coming to us from Beijing.
Beijing. I divide my time between Beijing, Singapore, and New York. So, and last year I was like 7 months in New York, and and that was actually, by the way, like the first time after the pandemic, right? So I was able to, take a dispassionate view of the U.S. Like, you know, I felt like I was a visitor looking from the outside, looking in, rather than, you know, being a participant. Took me a few months to sort of settle in and get used to life back in the U.S. But then I also spend a lot of time here in Beijing. So you know, when you talk geopolitics, I'm so not a fan of geopolitics because I have friends in both sides of the equation of the relationship. And I've seen, I know these two countries from the ground up. So I'm the last person that you get saying that it's a we against them kind of a story. But having said that, I think that relationship needs to be, the narrative, the story needs to be restated more accurately. And that's what I spend more of my time thinking and doing. In fact, right now, like the conversation that we had the other day, if I were to, continue on from finance to what geopolitics is, I would say that I am wrapping my mind around the idea of the dysfunctional state, and the power of the dysfunctional state. And I think that is what the U.S. is to itself and to the rest of the world. When you take the history of the U.S. from the independence start, 1776, it's always been dysfunctional. It's always had issues, and there's always been a mismatch between it, the ideal of the United States and the reality of the United States. And it's always an imperfect country. That little girl that recited that beautiful poem during, the presidential inauguration, 2 years ago, she said it beautifully, we're always a country in the making. So when George Floyd happened, three, 4 years ago, and the video reached me, I think easily within 4 or 5 hours of it happening, right? I mean, I watched it on my WhatsApp. Someone had viraled it, and I kept looking at it, and I said, wow, they finally captured it on video, and then I was one person who was not perturbed by it as an one-off event, because this has been the story of the U.S. all along, and it's just that and it was the same story when Martin Luther King was killed and all the streets went out on a rampage, all the cities went out on a rampage, there was upheaval, this and so on, in 1967, 68, well into 69. But by the time we reached 1970, the agenda had changed somewhat. It became the hippie movement. It became Vietnam War. It became gay rights, stuff like that. And the Black Lives Matter type of issue was postponed for another 20 years before they were able to deal with it. And this time, more graphically, because the audiovisual brought it home to people at home. Now, then when I spend time in countries like China or even Singapore, where I come from, which are far more organized and far more, coherent as a story. We are all beneficiaries of the dysfunctionality of the U.S. Just about every country in the world shares the same vision that the American Constitution promotes, which is the liberty and the rights of the individual, and the ability to free association and all that. I think the whole world subscribes to that. It's just that the U.S. lives through the discontinuity and the mismatch, whereas the rest of us are able to pick up on what we like and we pick and choose and then we make more perfect societies as a result, and that works for a while until we have the same problems the US does eventually. So that's how I describe what I think I see happening in the US. And then when I'm in China, what China has achieved in the last 30 years or 40 years is amazing. I think that anyone who wants to criticize China should start by recognizing what it actually has achieved. And when you come here and you spend time and you travel through the country and you're on high speed trains that go at 350 kilometers an hour, zipping across this amazing country, it's breathtaking what they've achieved in the 30 years. But we need to contextualize it to what was it that made it possible for China to make this transition? Because there's a lot to learn for any developing country in the world. There are many developing countries in the world that wish that they could have had the success that China has had. But telling the story in the context of 5,000 years of civilization and all that, I think that's rubbish. China had one very important episode of 10 years, which is the Cultural Revolution, which they basically did a mental reset, a total reset of the psyche of being Chinese. If you were in China, you'd see how modern it is. And then you go over to Taiwan or even to Hong Kong or even to a village, a Chinese village in Malaysia, and you'll see how traditional they are. They still have ancestral worship. Their families are still organized around clans and so on. China wiped that out in that 10-year period. And then when you say, why can't India be like China? You're asking India to have a cultural revolution like China did. And no other country in the world will want to pay the price that China paid, in that 10 years of incredible upheaval, stories of, children throwing their parents into prison for disagreeing with them intellectually, of the writer of the Chinese national anthem today. He would die in prison, during the Cultural Revolution, and so on and on and on. The number of people who paid a price, for protecting what they thought was tradition and values in the country, So you put that into the equation and you say, okay, now we see why no other country in the world can have the kind of progress that China has had.
A quick shout out to our sponsors, which you can locate via the sponsor page on geopoliticsandempire.com or whose links are included in every podcast description. I've tried privacy phones in the past, such as Silent Circle's Black Phone, which turned out to be a dud. The best and really only option so far is de-Googling your phone. Now, you can do it yourself, but I've never had the time to figure that out and simply got an Above phone. They sell de-Googled phones that come with a suite of software. They also provide support and a monthly Above privacy suite with many features such as a unique phone number, encryption, email, VPN, and so forth. If you're looking for a private phone, check out Above phone. Make sure to click on the Above phone link on geopoliticsandempire.com or via the podcast description so that we can enjoy a commission. Also, check out the Nomos Time Bank at nomos.net, which you can download in Spanish or English to your Apple or Google or de-Googled phone. Nomos allows people in your community to exchange services using time as a currency rather than fiat money. This will be one great way to survive in the coming algorithm ghetto. If you need health insurance, you can talk to my friend James Guzman of the Borderless Blog Podcast and Health Insurance. He offers free consultations. Simply schedule a time with him over at borderlesshealthinsurance.com. Finally, you can donate directly to Geopolitics and Empire, consult with me, the host, or become a member to join private monthly member Zoom calls where we shoot the breeze discussing world events.
Now, the other thing is this, that one of the things I just have made it a point in my life is to travel. And I've done about 110, I've done 110 countries. I have it on my app. I've got 85 more to go. And I know people have done far more than I have. So, and I'm not in a hurry to do the rest. I just take countries and regions step by step and then I absorb them. And something I've learned is this, very interesting. I went to Rwanda, and this is a country that has had a genocide only in within memory, it is 1994, 200,000 people killed, 800,000 people killed, 250,000 of them buried in the mausoleum or the monument, in downtown Kigali, right? And today, from the airport to the hotel, the streets are tree-lined. There are speed cameras, a zebra. My one test of a civilized society is zebra crossings, like the street crossing. And if you stand at the zebra crossings, the cars actually stop, they don't just zip past you like in many developing countries. So, and the zebra crossings work. And and people are highly civilized. I sat down with the CEO of the largest bank in the country, and so on. And you see what is it that made this country able to make incredible progress? In fact, they call Rwanda the Singapore of Africa now, or the Switzerland of Africa, because the CEO of the largest bank, she spent time in Switzerland, and then she came back to serve the country. And then I look at other countries that have had similar types of history. Ghana is another one. And then I think about China, and I say, how is it that, why is it that these countries can have such a dark past and make the transitions that they do? And I came up with this phrase, because they have seen the alternative. In fact, it was someone in Ghana who said to me that, despite all the economic problems that Ghana is going through right now, the transition of power is very stable. It's a very respectable country today. And when I asked someone, how is it that you've got such a stable political system? The answer I got was because they've seen the alternative. And the alternative was, a time in the past when the president brought in all the opposition members to the palace and shot them dead in front of live television. So the thing is that, I can keep going. Like Indonesia, for example, is the most functional democracy in the world today. Nobody talks about it because everything works. The presidents just come and go one after the other. They have one of the best presidents they ever had right now, Joko Widodo, and his term is coming to an end, and he's done an incredible job. And then he will be stepping down, and there will be an election. And holding together the democracy is amazing. And then you ask, how did Indonesia make this transition to a functioning democracy today? Again, it's because they've seen the alternative, which was during the 1997 economic Asian financial crisis, where Suharto had to step down and so on. And then the turmoil that they went through, to build the structures of functioning democracy, So the juxtaposing the stories of these functioning democracies and functioning economies against the American story is that America is always an imperfect society. And because it's an imperfect society, it can absorb a lot of the innovations that are transforming entire civilizations today. And if you ask me, the one thing that's different between the US and China, or there are two things that are very that underpins the fundamental difference between the United States and China. And one is information, the ability to deal with information, and the other is capital. In fact, a lot of the developments in China in the private sector was American capital. The ability of Chinese, private sector startups like Alibaba and Tencent and a whole list of them being able to raise capital in the U.S. The thing about information is that today we've got technology has made it possible that there's incredible symmetry of information between buyer and seller, regulator and buyer and seller, buyer and seller and unions and community. And the information that you have, I have, and everybody else has. On the one hand, it helps price discovery, for example, very well. But on the other hand, it creates opportunity for discontent like you wouldn't believe. And on top of that, you've got platforms like Twitter and what we're going to be on, like YouTube and so on, which accentuates the echo chamber, which is, people who share an opinion all coagulate together and they sound louder than they really are, and they are able to cause social disheaval. So the US is living through that. All other countries try to control that as far as they can, and of course it's the most controlled in China. So China looks like it's able to handle the transition into an information and network world well. But it eventually will have the troubles that the U.S. has today. And on top of that, in the U.S., you have this this challenge of large, big businesses being able to, commoditize everybody through the use of platforms. And then as a result, it causes disheavals in local communities, and society as a whole. And the role of big business in the information era. Now, I think that the U.S. will eventually work its way through these challenges. And at every period, there's usually a plateau that it reaches where it looks like the better society. And right now it doesn't look like it. But I think that whatever the U.S. experiences, the rest of the world will experience at some point in time. And that's right now in the information network element of it, and also in the area of capital. And in the area of capital, I have a whole set of theories about, the fact that capital itself is being invested in increasingly more ephemeral, assets which don't have an underlining value to it or an underlining business to it. And that in itself is another journey that the U.S. is leading the rest of us. So I wouldn't, call it, a sunset, civilization by any stretch of the imagination. It is pushing ahead, and it is paying a price as it pushes ahead into the network world.
So you seem to be bullish then on the U.S. Empire. I kind of wanted to play on this theme. There's a lot of talk now about, the world is bifurcating, unipolar world to a bipolar or multipolar world, East versus West. Washington, London and Brussels versus, Eurasia, a little bit of Mackinder in there and the world island and, this new Cold War 2.0. There's talk about the West is getting kind of hawkish regarding China and Taiwan. So there's a lot of this talk, Graham Mallison and the Thucydides trap. And so where do you see us going? Is there this potential for a military conflict, or is it going to be played out economically? And you seem to view the U.S. as still strong, which I'm tending to think that that's the case. And then how strong is China going forward? So any further thoughts on this sort of East versus West
This idea of East versus West, the idea of we against them, the Thucydides trap, that's a Western construct. One of the nicest thing of being Asian is that I don't need to subscribe to that. What I see happening, in fact, Farid Zakaria wrote The Rise of the Rest, right? Which is, the US is the most advanced, country in terms of technology and stuff, but the rest have risen up too. You just need to step out of the US, come to a place like Singapore or Japan, for a time, and you will see how much more organized and how much more valuable everyday life is as a, because they're functional societies. So the rest have caught up. And that in itself is an idea that many Americans just have to let it sink in, that we are not, not we on the plateau, where we on a perch and everybody else is on the plateau below. No, it's the abilities of different countries, whether it's Germany or China, Korea has caught up. So it's a multipolar world. And right now, even as we speak, because of the U.S. hegemony on finance, all of the other players, Saudi Arabia and the entire Arab bloc for oil, they're trying to find alternative relationships to one which is dominated by the U.S. And they will continue looking for those alternatives. Not all those alternatives will work. They also have conflicts of their own. China just did a deal with Saudi Arabia to be able to buy oil in renminbi. And the substance of that deal is the renminbi never leaves China. In other words, the Saudis have to leave the renminbi to be domiciled in China. And the only reason it works is because the Saudis also need to buy things from China. So they have an account to pay into. China is allowing foreign banks to have full access to renminbi accounts in China. So the money never leaves the country. The Saudi economy and any oil economy is predicated in dollars. So they will need dollars anyway because they need to pay for other things around the world. So when you go into the mechanics of any of the alternatives that are being developed, each of them have a problem of their own. When the U.S. Anthony Blinken goes around the world trying to make relationships with the rest of the world. 20 years ago, the U.S. had something to offer, which is, the multinational companies with large capital. So they'd go to Singapore and say, Hewlett-Packard wants to put in $10 billion worth of, manufacturing capability into Singapore. That makes a huge difference for a country like Singapore. It aligns the relationship to be very pro-American. Today, you go to Singapore, Singapore's largest trading partner is China, and so is two-thirds of the world today. You go to Brazil, the largest trading partner is China. You go to South Africa, the largest trading partner is China. You go to Saudi Arabia, the largest trading partner is China. The U.S. is discovering that everywhere it goes, there's a new equation that they need to deal with. So the negotiations changed. And on top of that, the U.S. has lost its manufacturing capability and its ability to build infrastructure. So when it goes to Africa, it has nothing to offer by way of being able to build roads and so on. You can talk down the Belt and Road program that China has sort of constructed over. And I know the history of the Belt and Road program from like 30 years ago, before it was called the Belt and Road program, and it had nothing to do with government or the Communist Party. It had everything to do with ordinary Chinese going out because life was really very hard in China. But these entrepreneurs have gone out and they've built incredibly functional communities, Chinese communities, In Ghana, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce in Ghana is 10,000 members strong, and that's just the members. So you know there's a lively Chinese community that comes with its own capital to be able to make a difference in these countries. So so when you say Tutsi's trap and so on, you're trying to frame it in a we against them model, when the numbers point out to a very different reality, which is that firstly, trade has become the most important determinant of geopolitical relationships today. And as long as China is able to keep its manufacturing capability, the lowest manufacturing hub in the world, it will be able to export that capability to the rest of the world. It already has done that. No country, even Mexico, Mexico's biggest trading partner is the US and Canada and then China. So even as close as the US, you would find that China is an equation that they need to deal with. Now, China's problem is to keep its manufacturing costs low enough for a longer period of time so that it can hold on to that to that part of the equation that it brings into the geopolitical sphere. It's losing that equation slowly because manufacturing is now being fragmented. Even countries like Bangladesh, which used to be a basket case, I think that, one of the former Secretary of State called it a basket economy, today has a per capita GDP that's higher than India, and they've built their own social infrastructure to be able to raise capital, to bring out the energy of women in the workforce, and then also the textile industry. They've brought more of the downstream activities back into Bangladesh. So they're not just picking cotton; they're also making finished goods, and they've become more functional as a result. Now that is more of a competitor to China than any of the rhetoric between the US and China. And so when you put all of that into the equation, when the US goes out to assert influence, it has to ask itself first, what is the influence that we want to assert around the world? And the only influence left is military, the ability to quickly resolve conflict. But it's an influence that it asserts at great cost to itself. When I'm in the US and I see roads not being repaired, schools having funding problems, libraries being closed down, and then I think about the fact that this country spent $9 trillion blowing the hell out of, of Afghanistan and Iraq over a 20-year period, that money could have easily gone into solving a lot of the problems. And in fact, even the Bernie Sanders, debate on Social Security, $40 billion, for goodness sakes. I mean, you have the money to deal with it. It's just that the money is being used for something else. So the U.S. Asserts global influence at great cost to itself. And that's where the narrative should be, and do we want to continue doing that? What should we be investing in? We are effectively a dysfunctional society. It's no fun being wealthy in the US because the moment you step on the street, you face the homeless, you run the risk of being robbed. The civil society is not as well developed as it used to be. When I put all of these into the equation, I think that the conversation has to be something totally different. It's a Western construct that it's always a we against them type of a mindset. Very often it's we against we, we against me, that kind of a construct. And why I say all this is because in Singapore, for example, we are actually made up of different races. A lot of people think that Singapore is Chinese, but 70% of the population is Chinese, but 10% is Indian and 14% is Malay. And then there are a whole range of other races. So if you talk about multiculturalism, You know, we've had it longer than the US, you know, and a lot of the rest of the world has been multicultural for a long time. And that's something that we need to respect and even draw from. And the interesting thing is that Lee Kuan Yew, when he was alive, he insisted that every community have a self-help program to raise its own standards and deal with its own problems. You know, so the Indian community, which tended to be made up of either professionals at a high level or you know, people whose ancestry is indentured laborers who are at the lowest rung of society, you know, they were told to have their own, you know, teachers helping their kids, their own entrepreneurs funding, you know, poverty eradication programs and so on, and then the Chinese and the Malays and so on. So the idea that you help yourself is a very highly developed idea in Asian communities, and so I carry that with me when I look at problems that you know, different countries face. And in the U.S. Today, everyone just looks at the state and saying, you know, the state should help me solve this problem. You know, and I think that and the U.S. didn't used to be that way. And I think that you know, some of these mindset issues need to be you know, reconstructed if you're going to solve some of these problems. But having said that, technology is driving us you know, well into the future, and it's setting the agenda for us, and we need to, you know, cope and keep up with it.
Yeah, and then again, to look extrapolate a bit, get your thoughts, you know, talking about China, and then in your book you touch on the next financial crisis, mentioning it, how it will be more asset light than previous ones, and then of course what's going on in Ukraine. Some people are saying you know, the war in Ukraine can be a catalyst for many other things, that it's wiping out the middle class, it's impoverishing Europe as a result of, you know, sanctions that are backfiring and inflation and things like this. And so just your thoughts, I guess, on any future financial crisis, and then how will Ukraine change anything going forward in your mind?
One of the things I think about war, whether it's Ukraine or even World War II, the Germans inventing the V1 and V2 rockets and so on, is how war speeds up technology development like you wouldn't believe, and the ability of you know, the industrial, the defense industrial complex to innovate is just amazing. Every time I see you know, they call it drone shows, right? In Guangzhou in China, they've perfected the art of having 1,000 or 5,000 drones up in the air and at night with lights on them, and then they're all programmed to be synchronized, and it's so beautiful. That technology comes from war, you know, and you know, so we're going to see lots of new technology, new innovations, you know, from the Ukraine war for sure. You know, the quality of the economy in the next 10 to 20 years, and I say this in my book, in the last chapter. In fact, writing the book was very interesting because I started with my origins are in the banking industry. So I started by trying to extrapolate where banking is going. And then halfway through the book, I was already talking about finance. And towards the end of the book, I was talking about entire civilizations, because if finance is going to become increasingly personalized, it's going to have an incredible impact on how society itself is organized. And I say this in the book, which is that the US economy, it's not inconceivable that it can grow from the $21 trillion that it is today, GDP, to $45 trillion. And I've now, you know, watched several you know, economists saying this now. In fact, only yesterday I heard that there's a chance that that the US might be issuing you know, 1,000-year bonds, treasury bonds. It's not inconceivable that the US will be capable of doing it. And that brings us back to the power of the dysfunctional state. And the National Statistics Department in the US has already started tweaking the notion of GDP to not just be manufactured goods, but also soft assets like software, like services, and so on. And when you see the creation of digital assets, you know, cryptocurrencies and so on, you realize that they are not based on any underlining business, any underlining value. And the economy is just going to trudge on in that direction. You know, and it trudges on in that direction because the only solution to the inability to meet debt commitments is to create more debt and export it globally so that the rest of the world will absorb and be invested in the US. And the reason the treasury bonds have had a long run of trust in the rest of the world is because the rest of the world trusted the US. We are right now at a point where many countries around the world, even US allies, Switzerland, Israel, are defunding their treasury holdings and rewriting their the central bank balance sheets not to hold treasury bonds. And the US has to react to keep treasury bonds keep the rest of the world interested in investing in US debt. So it's a dysfunctional country that, out of one act of desperation to the next, exports, its debt and its capital to the rest of the world to be invested in. And why do I say this with confidence? Because that's exactly what the U.S. did in 1971, when for the previous 20 years, the entire discussion was how to hold the value of the dollar against the price of gold. Fall day in 1971, President Nixon just went on television on a Sunday night and said to the rest of the world, you know what, we're not going to hold it against the price of gold. We're going to let our currency float, on a trade-weighted basis with the rest of the world. And guess what happened? The rest of the world had to follow. Many countries then had to, float their currencies to find their value on a trade-weighted basis because holding it against the price of gold was becoming untenable and was most untenable to the U.S. So when you look at every major decision that the U.S. has made, it's always been at critical points, out of a no-choice situation, out of desperation, entering World War II, no war, then Pearl Harbor, and then the U.S. becomes the major player. So I every time I see a debate, right now there's a debate as to how to regulate cryptocurrencies in the U.S. and the SEC has a mindset, and then the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who has a central bank mindset, putting her weight behind it. So those discussions will continue, and then the decision that the U.S. finally makes, it always ends up making it out of desperation, and the desperation will come when the U.S. needs a new trick to keep itself investable, as an asset. And then I also say this, that the banking industry went through exactly that same transition. Bankers have books like, this time it's different, but no, it's not different. We are looking at the same things. But we're not looking at the same things, because when you look at a bank's balance sheet in 1971, at the start of the end of the Bretton Woods era, and then 1984, 1987, 1992, 1996, 2008, and then today, the balance sheet has become increasingly ephemeral. In 1971, the balance sheet of an average American bank or any bank around the world was deposits and real money, deposits and loans. 1984, the American bank balance sheet had changed into mortgages, but mortgages were hard assets of actual properties. By 1987, it was securities. By 1992, It was the beginning of derivatives of mortgages. In other words, the banks were learning how to package their mortgages and sell it off so that their capital costs would be lower. By the time you reach the 2008 crisis, it was derivatives of derivatives. It was futures and so on, which the Wall Street banks were trading on. So the balance sheet has changed. So what I'm saying is that the next financial crisis will be on an increasingly ephemeral asset base that is not based on any underlying asset. And that actually sets the stage for the digital economy that we are walking into right now. The US is the best place economy to take us there. So when the US economy becomes 45 trillion and therefore the rest of the world still depends on it as an engine for growth, a lot of it is on ephemeral assets. And then I also talk about the fact that companies as engineering intensive as GE are talking about the fact that the data in GE is more valuable than the actual manufacturing business, and so on and so on and so on. So I think I see the I see the direction where we're going. Then the question is, how do you manage an ephemeral economy, an economy that is not based on any underlying asset, and the disciplines that are involved? And the U.S. honestly is in a position to answer this question more than any other economy in the world because of the freedom of information and the fact that it is the first victim of the future. It's the economy that is facing some of these realities up ahead to the rest of the world.
You're one of the first persons that sort of explain where we're going in such a unique way. So if I get it right, it seems like, as you say, we are going into this CBDC, digital currency, metaverse world. The U.S. is kind of leading us there, and China. It seems like, so they're going to pull off another 1971 to sort of push us into this space. Is that kind of how it's going to look like?
That's what the U.S. is going to do. They're going to pull up. That's a nice way of putting it. They're going to pull off another 1971 and another 1938. And another 1911, the U.S. has been doing this all through its history. It's one act of desperation after the other. The War of Independence was funded with debt, which then eventually by the early 20th century resulted in the concept of a central banking, which is the bank as the bank that lends to all other banks. So there's nothing new in this story. It's a pattern that the U.S. has been building on. The only thing that has changed is that the other countries in the world are in a position to match that or to vary that journey. And when I think of the U.S. in this way, I also then look back at history and say, which other civilizations had this problem? Or this kind of a scenario, it was really the Roman Empire, the U.S. is about, 250 years old now? 200, and the Roman Empire sort of trudged along for 1,000 years, the U.S. is still a long way to go that way. But what happened in the process? The rise of the Ottoman Empire on the east, the rise of the Germanic tribes in the north, the rise of the northern African empires, to try and challenge the dominance of the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire was trouble every day. It came to a point where they were seeing a new consul every year almost, and it looked really dysfunctional. But the one thing that the Roman Empire did well was the ability to absorb the learnings from the rest of the the rest of the world, actually, and it was able to be organized militarily to go out there and to hold the empire together, which are some of the elements that are parallel to where the U.S. is right now, and so when it finally disintegrated. The Roman Empire disintegrated in a whimper, meaning that the consul couldn't pay his debt, and a German mercenary who used to live in Rome, came in and just took over, and that's how the Roman Empire finally disintegrated. In other words, 10 years before it disintegrated, everyone knew that the end was near. But I don't think the end is anywhere near for the U.S. today.
It's absolutely fascinating. Something else you touch on in your book, and I've heard other people use this term, networked states. And so going forward, given everything we've discussed, we've got this concept of the Westphalian nation state, and now everything's changing. You've got the EU, which is a supranational regional mechanism. They're talking about replicating that in Latin America. And so things are kind of changing. And on top of that, everything you're talking about, the whole digital space and big tech and these companies are becoming much more powerful than nations. And so what do you see as the future form of state and how does it change?
So my next book, I tentatively called it The Winning Civilization. But then as I'm writing it, I'm actually changing my thoughts, and it might actually end up being a different title that captures the idea better. Now, the big difference between China and the US right now is that China, for example, wants to build its own domestic capability on the chip industry and a lot of technologies. It wants to make it local. It wants to be self-sufficient. When you take any U.S. Technology, you take the chip, it was made in easily 10 to 12 countries. It's not a U.S. invention. And I have friends in the chip design business. They're talking from Silicon Valley to Japan to Korea to Singapore to back to Europe in Belgium and then back to Silicon Valley. Every day, that's how they make decisions. You take the 787 Dreamliner; it's made in 16 different countries. You take the iPhone; it's not even made in the U.S. and it's considered to be a U.S. product. So the U.S. has aced the ability to own the IP, but not worry about where manufacturing takes place. When you take any U.S. product, the iPhone being the best example, it doesn't have to be American to be American. And yet the Chinese are so hung up about being domestic, they get the equation totally wrong. New advances in technology, you need to practically draw from very specialized skills that are honed somewhere in the world. And so for any country or any civilization to ace the game, to become a dominant civilization in the future, will need to figure out a way to create a network economy that makes them able to draw from best practices from anywhere in the world. The iPhone glass, when Steve Jobs originally wanted to perfect it, he put the phone into his pocket and it was being scratched by his keys. And he said, no, we got to get a glass that is, both light and unscratchable. And he found it in Japan. And that was 6 months before the first iPhone was launched. So the ability to network and to draw from developments around the world is a survival instinct of any future dominant civilization. And on top of that, it's not just the multinationals are supranational now. It's also the network effect is making individuals supranational. In other words, you and I have friends around the world, and we network and we get resources and we have business. We actually buy and sell from people around the world. So the ability of the nation state to hold an economy together is increasingly difficult to hold out to. So anyone thinking about the idea of nation states have to think in terms of the network state. And what that network state is, it's almost like a state that sits on top of a state. So you'd be a strong economy if you're networked with the rest of the world. And then you need to think about what's domestic, what's local, what's me that I need to preserve in that relationship, in that equation. And I think that's what nation states need to be thinking about. I'm thinking a lot about this because, in Southeast Asia, we have many nation states which are subprime don't have the critical mass to become dominant players. Eventually, they're all vassal states of the U.S. or of China and so on. So, what can these countries do to keep the economy going, create jobs, and hold together as a country? A lot of it has to do with giving the best form of education to your people, not to be nationalistic, but to be globalist. I've just said a word that has become a bad word today, globalist. At least globally conscious, if not globally connected, and then let them figure out what they want to do. So I think that this idea of nation state is a work in progress right now. And I think that it's countries and leaders who know how to benefit from a networked world, who will be best able to hold their countries together. Now, I say that fully mindful that countries like India and China keep reminding the rest of the world that 200 years ago these were the largest economies in the world, that they were, hamstrung by by colonialism, that destroyed them and all that. I don't buy that story, and in fact, I think firstly, India could not have held together if the British didn't come and stitch, easily about 15 different kingdoms together, and the sultanates and so on, and then made a country out of that. Before that, it was basically, fiefdoms, located on the same peninsula almost, and China had its own problems, which is by the 1850s, the population had grown incredibly, that it had problems managing its own economy, and yet it changes the focus to what the West did to try and break up China and so on. China was disintegrating by itself. And then when you think of what technology is doing to us today, it is either increasing the value of the individual or decreasing or commoditizing the value of the individual, depending on what you put into the individual's brains. It is no longer true that you need a large economy to be functional. In other words, having a large population may actually work against you because everything is being automated. So what do people do? And so you need to start thinking about, robotics, you need to take productivity to its extreme, and so on. And then what you do with your people? Countries like China and India have to answer this question. In fact, I think that China's population decline may well work in its favor, because by the time it's now 1.5 billion, apparently it's going to go down to as low as 850 million. China has absorbed and has embraced productivity wholeheartedly. When I first came into this country, I was surprised. If you go into a railway station in India, you will see that the porter is so afraid of automation that he insists on carrying all your bags physically on his head and on his hands and everything, because he wants to show that he's still relevant. Whereas in China, they embrace productivity openly and then figured out something else for the manual laborer to do. And they're continuing doing that. They're not afraid of the fact that a job can be taken over by a machine. You go to the cinemas or the movies, you buy it on the machine rather than in person. That calls into question the productivity of the manual laborer and and village people who are migrating into the cities. And for now, there's a lot of delivery service and so on. And even that's going to be taken over by drones and stuff like that. So the countries that are brave enough to deal with the productivity element that's coming on stream will now need to figure out, you know, what do they do with the rest of the population? And I say that everything depends on what you put into the head of the individual. If what you put into the head of the individual is vote for my party because I'll give you a job, then you are creating your own problem for the future. You know, so that's how I assess how different countries are preparing for the future. And I think that this whole dynamics and this the dysfunctionality of societies holding together is most pronounced in the US right now. And we can go on talking about how difficult it is in the US today, you know, to hold a job, inflation and all of that. So, you know, it's the countries that figure it out that will take us on to the next level.
Yeah, we've covered a lot. And I think you're one of my guests that seems the most positive, optimistic going forward. Is there then, any other issue you wanted to get across or any final thought for us?
Well, final thoughts is that look at the numbers. Always be dispassionate in assessing the real challenges that we face, and that, you know, when you travel and so on, don't try to superimpose your reality on someone else, and because that person's reality or that country's reality may well have an answer that you may not be, you know, looking at. So that's why sometimes I have the most surprising findings in the most difficult countries, you know, Rwanda, Bangladesh, even down to Burundi. I learned a few things there, and and then you piece it together and try and make sense of where we are going, and then also of course that there are some hints from history, the ability of mankind to organize themselves are sometimes based on very simple, elements that we may not have even thought through. The reason the Mongolians were able to control just about a third of the world's land surface in the 1200s was simply because they figured out a way to tame horses. And that made and their neighbors, even China, hadn't done that. So eventually, the rest of the world learned, that kind of thing. So the elements that will be triggers that will change the future may well be much simpler than we realize.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Mongolia. I lived in the Gobi for a year doing Peace Corps, I just read this week Peter Turchin, who's a great historian, social scientist, just published he posted a paper that was published, I think, exactly on what you're talking about, how they discovered thousands of years ago of how horses were developed to be used for cavalry and that sort of thing. And so, all right, again, we've covered a lot. I highly recommend your book. All of your links will be in the description, but is there any project you want to mention or best place to find you on the internet?
EmmanuelDaniel.com, and then from there I take the visitor to everything else that I'm doing and I'm working on right now. And thank you for the privilege, OJ.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.